This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Book Waves Art Waves programs on KPFA FM and Pacifica Syndication. In the late 1980s, crime and mystery fiction by women skyrocketed. Even so, awards were still being given to mostly male writers, and in 1987, the organization Sisters in Crime was formed. In Berkeley at KPFA, Richard A. Lupoff and I, hosts of the Probabilities radio program, having drifted from science fiction into mysteries and later into general fiction and narrative nonfiction, we noticed the trend pretty early on and began interviewing these pioneer writers one by one, local writers like Marcia Muller and Sue Dunlap, and writers from out of town, Sue Grafton, or from overseas, such as P.D. James. These interviews, the Sisters in Crime interviews, were all conducted in the 1980s and 1990s, and because of the switch from analog tape to digital, have not been heard until the new century began, until now. It is appropriate to begin this series of interviews with the first president of Sisters in Crime, Sarah Paretsky. It was recorded March 16, 1991, while she was in the Bay Area for a mystery conference. At the time, 6 V.I. Warshawski novels had been published, and a film starring Kathleen Turner would be released a few months later. As of July 2026, Sarah Paretsky has published 22 novels in the V.I. Warshawski mystery series and 2 non-series novels, along with 3 short story collections and 2 works of nonfiction. The most recent V.I. novel, Pay Dirt, was published in 2024.
V.I. Warshawski is the most hard-boiled of the female detectives. What brought you to write her and create her?
V.I. came from a couple of different places. The first was I was working as a marketing manager for a large multinational insurance company back in the late 70s and really through the 80s to the late 80s. And when you are a woman in management, and especially at that period, we were really the pioneers in management. There was support for us, to be sure, but there was also a lot of pressure just to see how far we could be pushed before we would crack. In fact, one of the women in the company who was promoted to a very senior level of management, my boss came to me and said he had a bet with some of the guys on when he would be able to make her cry in public. So a lot of us were taking that kind of heat, and really V.I. came to me one day in a meeting. I was sitting there, my lips were saying, "Gosh, Fred," my boss, "what an idea." And the balloon over my head was saying, "You expletive." And suddenly I thought, V.I., a woman who's doing a job that didn't exist for women when we started high school, a woman taking those kinds of pressures, but someone who could say what was in the balloon over her head.
Had you done any mystery writing before that?
No, I had really been writing very privately my whole life. I had never tried to write for publication, and really until I got into my 30s, it didn't occur to me that I might write for publication. When I wrote the first book, of course, when you write a book, you have a fantasy that it will be published. I specifically wanted to do something with a woman private eye, because as a lifelong mystery reader, you know, you start noticing the way that women have traditionally been depicted in private eye novels, and, you know, Chandler as the classical example. If a woman is sexually active, she's evil. And so I had wanted to have a character, write a book, try to in some way turn the tables on that, establish a different image, you know, all those kinds of things.
At that time, were any of the current women writers writing
Linda Barnes, Marcia Muller, Julie Smith, Mia McCarr, Marilyn Wallace,
Marcia Muller has published her first book with Sharon McCone in 1977. I have to confess that I didn't actually read it, or it didn't come to my attention until I was well launched on Indemnity Only. There were a few people doing rather isolated things. To me, in some ways, Marcia was the first, although there were Carolyn Heilbrun with Amanda Cross had been around for quite a while, but was not a private investigator in the real sense of the word.
Now, V.I. Has an interesting history. Her father was a cop, and her mother was an immigrant Jewish from Italy. She has an alcoholic aunt, a nasty uncle who lives far away. Where is that in?
He's in Kansas City, actually.
Which is where you're from?
Near there, yeah.
Was that deliberate?
Well, I keep thinking that I might want to go set some crime in the old Kansas countryside, and so it was handy to put a relative down there.
And she lives in a walk-up that has, in the basement floor, an elderly man with his dog. Now, is that dog similar to the dog you own?
Yes, it's similar to the dog that I own, but much better behaved. I mean, someone really trained that dog, unlike the people who own the dog I own.
V.I. Warshawski, first of all, what does the V.I. mean, and what does she like to be called?
When I started with her, I wanted to give her what seemed to me to be a Polish last name. And even though my own last name is Polish, I'm very bad on the ethnic origins of names. So I thought, okay, Warsaw, that's in Poland. Warszawski, that's got to be Polish. Although, in fact, a snot at the University of Chicago Slavics department came to me at a party one night and said, "Well, you know, you've come up with a last name of no definable place of national origin." I said, "It's Polish." And he said, "Well, not the way you've spelled it." But anyway, it's Polish. So that's life at the University of Chicago.
You do love academics.
And somehow the initials just seem to go with it when I had the last name. And that's why I always think of her as V.I., because I wrote about her for several months before I came up with the names. The names are Victoria Iphigenia, and I made a list of all the names I could think of that began with V, and of course Victoria, with its implications of victory and power and those kinds of things, seemed appropriate. But then, because I had given her an Italian mother who had trained to sing opera, she was named Victoria for Victor Emmanuel II, not the third, not the fascist collaborator, but his father. And then Iphigenia. I'm a little tired of it, but it's something that I'm sort of stuck with the character. But to her, at least at the time that I was writing it, Vicky seemed like a kind of a patronizing thing to be called.
She has this large family. She also has
a cousin, Boom Boom, I think, right. Definitely needs a little thought. Yeah.
Boom Boom, the hockey player. This is somewhat different from the other private eyes who seem not to have their family all over them all the time. Did this just come out, or was it something new that you thought of?
I can't say that I thought of doing it. I didn't sit down to write for a market or to make things that seemed to be distinctive. I actually, because when I started writing, I was very nervous and uncertain about whether I could execute. I tried following as many conventions of the form as I could, and in the form, the private eye is always an orphan, a loner, all these things. It's not a style that I'm personally comfortable with, and as time has gone by, it's just become very... I somehow can't seem to write well about her unless I'm writing about her in the context of her personal life. And I think one of the problems... I'm having a terrible time with the book that I'm working on now, the worst time that I've had actually with any of the books that I've written. You know, I've written 100,000 words and the end isn't in sight and I'm going crazy. But I was realizing the other day that I think one of the real problems I have with it is that it isn't personally grounded the way the last four books have been.
The most recent, Burn Marks, I thought, is it pronounced Elena?
Uh-huh.
I thought that she was the most wonderful character for all of the unconventionalities, to say the least. She's a mess, okay? But she has a wonderful charm to her, or am I just putting something there that's not there?
Well, she isn't supposed to be, I mean, she is in some ways god-awful, but she is supposed to be likable. What actually, years ago I worked for a small company that we clipped newspaper articles on issues of we thought were socially important, and then we did publications based on all these articles. And 20 years ago, I read this story about a retirement hotel in Minneapolis where old circus performers all live, and where there were two women who would relieve the guys of their pension checks once a month. And, you know, women in their 60s, and I guess one was late 60s and one was in her 70s, and they were essentially turning tricks like Elena does. And it just, they just seemed like people who were having a good time. They all liked living together. And so that was in my mind when I thought of Elena, I guess more charm than hideousness.
Speaking of burn marks, since it is the most recent Warshawski novel until the new one is completed, of course, she becomes involved with just the most god-awful mess of crooked politicians, crooked real estate people. There is some implication of an insurance scam there, and I'm sure because of your experience in the insurance industry, you know whereof you write. Is Chicago really that bad?
Chicago is not as bad as it was before the... There's a federal decision called the Shachman decision, which affected patronage hiring in the city. Now that the city politicians don't have so many jobs to hand out, the level of corruption is lower than it used to be. On the other hand, the county still has enormous amounts of patronage, the county in which Chicago sits, patronage jobs, and the real political power now is with the county politicians, which is why it's set with that connection. But yes, I think that there's a tremendous amount of corruption in the city and the county, and the prime basis of it is in contracting, the construction industry, and all the ways that that comes together. And see, what politicians have to sell is zoning permits, and what contractors, and so contractors fund the campaigns, and then they get the early running on projects and where it might be possible to build. And it doesn't have to be public money that's being spent, just has to be that here's land that might be available to build on.
The problem of the fraudulent minority-owned firms
is a serious problem, although there are many good minority-owned firms, but I guess the most notorious is the one involving Noah Robinson, Jesse Jackson's half-brother, who, well, he's under all kinds of indictments right now, but who boasted on the contracts that he got for a new State of Illinois building that I don't think he had any employees and that he had never set foot in the place, and he just fronted for some white contractors.
On our way down here to the station today, we were talking about people's feelings about the government, lack of confidence in the government as a sort of different generational experience that people of different ages have had. And while we are taping this this interview, it's just the week of the L.A. police beating that was captured by an amateur videotape. Do you feel that it's all falling apart, or what's going on?
I really think the lesson of the last 25 years has been that when people organize locally, that they can take some control over their lives and that they can exert some power, and that when they don't, they're terribly fragmented and terribly abused. When I first moved to Chicago, I was working in a community service program on the city's southwest side, which was an area of the city that, you know, blue-collar, little bungalows, people who came out 90-1 for Richard Daley, and they had nothing that the city wanted except their votes. They were just reamed by a connection of banks and real estate companies and the racism of the city government. I don't know, it was a heartbreaking introduction to the city, and I think it's permanently colored my view of the city. And I keep thinking, you know, if only they would have been able to form a block club or even just one small thing where they could get together and not be individually taken advantage of as they were, things would have been different. I just think that I don't think governments operate out of conspiracies or anything like that. I think you just get big organizations that take on a life of their own and mow over what's in their paths.
Both Burn Marks and Bloodshot deal with corruption. And Bloodshot deals with the corruption involved in industrial disease and trying to cover it up. V.I. Warshawski is herself a feminist. If someone calls her a little lady, she's likely to call them back an old goat. How do you see your books in a political sense? Do you think that the fact that you're using corruption and industrial, felonies as a backdrop is simply because that's what the backdrop of detective novels, or do you think there's something else going on? Do you have a, I don't want to say an ulterior motive, but do you have another point?
When I started writing the first book, I was working then in the insurance industry, and I set it in insurance because it was something that I knew about, and I wanted to make the job as easy on myself as I could. Stuart Kaminsky, who gave me tremendous advice and support through the first book, suggested that I continue with white-collar crime as a way to have something to hang, if it turned into a published series, hang it on. But I've found that over time that, I guess as I get older, in some ways I get angrier, certainly somewhat more passionate about some of these issues. And I feel, I look at the city and I think of all the energy, or look at the country as a whole for that matter, that we put into searching for, arresting, prosecuting, and convicting nickel and dime drug dealers, or in the case of murder, someone who may be committing a gang murder in the inner city. And I do not want to belittle that at all. I mean, if you murder someone, it's great grief to that person's family, and I don't want to say that it's a trivial crime. But I do believe that that tremendous damage is done by large institutions that that we don't take nearly as seriously. For example, a couple of years ago, well, just right now, what we have going on with Charles Keating, the banks and the savings and loan, one of Keating's little marketing tricks was to take elderly depositors and to target market them, get them to sell their federally insured CDs, and to buy junk bonds in the companies that Drexel was floating. Now that those banks have gone bust, and now that the companies have gone bust and aren't paying on the paper, we don't know how many of those old people have starved to death, how many of them are out of their homes, how many of them have had to turn to robbery to support themselves. And, you know, this man could have killed hundreds of people that he'll never be held accountable for. And I guess as time has gone by, I've started feeling more and more passionate about those kinds of issues. And so my books in some way have started to be maybe more doctrinaire, I don't know, in trying to show what happens when big institutions do flex their muscles in these ways.
Well, what about Warshawski's feminism? Do you see that getting stronger? How do you see that in the mix?
Warshawski's certainly a feminist as an aspect of her character, but I don't see it. I guess I see it more as evidenced in how the choices that she makes and how she lives her life, more than specific issues that she tackles or doesn't tackle, or things that she says or how she does them. I've been at a conference at Berkeley today on women and the mystery, and one of the things that has come up is, why don't some of these women have more lovers and more sex in their lives? And I've been thinking about this lately with VI, and I came to this sort of unpleasant conclusion that I'm so involved with her life that I can't, that I don't have the graciousness to let her have a private life with someone else. So I'm trying in the book that I'm working on to loosen up and give her the same pleasures that I might like to have.
But do you feel that private eyes, detectives in general, and especially female, or is there a distinction between the males and females, there seems to be a strangely puritanical thread running through the mystery field? For all we have, especially on the old paperback, sleazy covers with you know, women with dresses cut to their navels. But when you actually read the book, there's a kind of puritanism there, or is there?
That's a curious point. I think in some ways the way that the private eye was conceived by Chandler was very much in the kind of the mythic mold of the old Western cowboy, you know, someone like the Virginian. And that person does remain rather aloof from the people around them. One of the problems with writing a series character is that the person that is most intimate with the detective is the reader. And when you bring a lover into the books, you're really distracting from that primary relationship. And it's a difficult problem to resolve. I mean, some people love Susan Silverman, for example, with Spencer, but I don't. I feel like it's really pulled the books off center.
Well, what about a character like, I think, Carrie of the Unknown, of the Nameless Detective, or Kinsey Millhone's boyfriend? I mean, what about those?
I haven't read Sue's most recent book, so I didn't know that Kinsey had a steady boyfriend. She did have an involvement, actually, with a psychopath who turned out to try to kill her, which was a rather curious episode and must have been rather difficult to think about and write. The other thing is that you want the character to have a reason for being in the book, because the resolution of the crime story is, after all, the resolution of the crime, not the resolution of the romance. So there has to be a reason connected with the crime for bringing in a lover.
You've been writing these books for approximately 10 years now, and they have received, I think, a very, very enthusiastic reception from the reading public. I'd like to ask you about a couple of specific responses. The 1984 novel, Deadlock, won an award called Friends of American Writing Award. Mm-hmm. What's the story of that?
This is a wonderful group of women who are really, on the whole, rather old. I mean, in the 70s, 80s, some even in their late 90s, who have been around since the 20s and support books by Midwestern writers, sort of an 11-state area. And every year they give a prize to an adult novel and a children's book written by a Midwesterner, and a new book. It has to be one of your first three books. So they're a group that really is trying to help new writers get started. This was the first time they had ever given an award to a mystery, and they've been my most enthusiastic local supporters, having taken the chance and given me the award. They're like a collection of grandmothers looking after me. It's just wonderful.
3 years later, in 1987, you were named Woman of the Year, a Woman of the Year, by Ms. Magazine. What now? That seems very distant from Friends of American Writing.
That was the last, 87, I think, was the last year with Ms. under its old ownership before they then went through all these gyrations of selling and then finally closed and resold. And I think that they were trying then to reach out to as broad a spectrum of women as they could. That was the year they named Martina. That was the closest I'll probably ever get to Martina, whom I really adore, or admire greatly anyway. I think that one of the contributing editors was a Chicagoan and really helped make that happen. And I guess that there was a sense among some of the Ms. editors that having a woman detective who was kind of solving her own problems was, in their opinion, an important fictional model.
On the other hand, there has been some negative response. I'd like to quote, I'm sure you're familiar with a book called Silk Stockings, mm-hmm. When Women Write of Murder by Victoria Nichols and Susan Thompson. They take a pretty hard shot at VI. They say, for instance, unfortunately, Warshawski, in her anger and her aggressive pugnacity, is one of the least attractive heroes we've recently encountered. She may have a sense of justice, but it seems self-serving at best. And they go on, but I will not. That's pretty rough stuff.
I think that you always feel hurt when someone has negative things to say about you. I guess that's inevitable. But it's good also to step back and try to think about it. When I get negative criticism, I do try to think whether it's something that I ought to be working to change. But in general, I think you have to think about how we think as a society about what women should be like and what men should be like, gender roles, and specifically what it means to be feminine or to be masculine. And I think that there is a group of people, men and women, who fear that any time a woman seems to be stepping out of certain rather narrowly defined ways of behaving, that she suddenly become masculine rather than becoming just a different kind of woman. She's no longer a woman at all. She's someone suffering from that terrible disease of penis envy who hasn't got it under control. And I have to confess that I did tend to have that reaction to that kind of comment.
Would you say that Warshawski then is no more abrasive in her own way, let's say, than a Marlowe?
Yeah, I mean, V.I. is abrasive in her own way, and I would say that she's more abrasive than many people. But, you see, I'm more abrasive than many people, and I think of myself as a feminine kind of woman, perhaps erroneously, but, you know, sometimes I say things that I wish I hadn't that are just too mean or hard or hurtful, but I don't, you know, that makes me an unpleasant person, not an unwomanly woman.
How much like you do you think is V.I.?
Well, V.I. unfortunately has to share my political values. You know, poor thing, she doesn't have a voice of her own. What V.I. really represents to me are the changes that many women in America have been struggling with over the past 20 years. Not so much my own, but trying to find a balance between the personal, the political, and the professional, and not always succeeding in balancing it well.
One other question about V.I., which came to me from a big fan of yours. She said, I love V.I., but why do you always have her beaten up, tortured, banged up, scrunched up, and left for dead in virtually every book?
Well, you have to tell your friend that that's a question that comes so deep out of my unconscious that I haven't got a good flip answer. To be probably more honest than is necessary or helpful to anyone, I have to think that really I'm a rather angry person and that a lot of the violence in my books is a kind of a metaphor or an expression of that. V.I. gets beaten up more because I often feel mentally pummeled, and that's probably a concretization of how at least I've often historically felt. And then she has to be able to write herself and go on and make it work and show that she can't be destroyed. And a person who was either a better integrated person emotionally or had a less violent upbringing or, you know, some combination of those things, a better person than I would write less violently, perhaps.
Did you have a particularly violent upbringing?
Yes, I think that I did, actually. There was a lot of both physical and verbal violence in the household that I grew up in.
And do you have a relationship with your family now?
Yeah, I do. I'm the only female in a large family. I have four brothers. And I'm kind of the Grand Central Station, you know, everybody communicates through me, which is, I think, something that perhaps one ought not to allow, but it happens.
To contrast or to compare the real Sarah Paretsky and the fictitious V.I. Warshawski, it seems to me that she's the fulcrum of a large and contentious family also. We've already mentioned her Aunt Elena, her cousin Boom Boom, Aunt Rosa, cousin Albert. Who have left out?
Of the family?
Well, anyway.
Well, there are lots that you don't even
uncle
know
in,
about.
In Kansas
uncle
City.
Peter, and he has children, and one of them, Petra, has just run away from home to take part in anti-war activities in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows about that yet except me and now you two.
Would you say then that this is a reflection of the real Sarah Paretsky's life?
Oh, inevitably it is, but I wouldn't want to push at it too far. Mm-hmm. I think, as I was saying earlier, that what seems to work for me writing about V.I. is to be able to set a personal context, and that's why these relatives keep popping up out of the woodwork.
But no, she has inputs from non-family members, some of whom she selected and others of whom she's sort of stuck with. I'm thinking specifically of the contrast between Letty Herschel on the one hand and Bobby Mallory on the other. How about those two or other people in her life?
Mr. Contreras,
yeah. I think that Lottie, writers talk about things writing themselves, and I always think it's a sort of just a peculiar, not very credible kind of concept. But Lottie is someone who I brought into the first book. She's a doctor, and V.I. needed a doctor. And she was to be a walk-on, walk-off character who showed up like Doc Vollmer in the Rex Stout books when a doctor was needed and just ended up becoming a major character. And I think probably in some ways works for V.I. as some older women have worked for me in establishing a sense of community, of of a place of refuge. And then as I've become older and stronger, I've become able to be giving back and not just taking. And these relationships are among the most important in my life. And I suppose that Lottie really reflects that. With Bobby Mallory, yes. The problem with Bobby is that, I mean, I was very much following the stereotype of the Private Eye novel with friction between the police and the PI, and inevitably, I think, even in reality, there is or there would be. To me, he became an awfully stereotypical figure, and in Burn Marks, I felt that I had to resolve that relationship. And really, he's not going to be in future books. The book that I'm writing now, he doesn't even appear. He's only referred to every now and then as the lieutenant by some of the younger officers. Some of the friction continues, but there are other dimensions. In fact, V.I. is having an affair in the current book with one of the police officers, Conrad Rawlings, who made his first appearance in Bitter Medicine.
What about Mr. Contreras?
I don't know. Mr. Contreras is another character who came out of nowhere. I think that when you are a strong woman or a woman who's trying to maybe is a little more abrasive or has some of these more strident qualities, that a lot of times you find that significantly older men are very attracted to you. That in some ways they're safe relationships because they won't cross a sexual line, and they're safe for them, too, because you're the kind of woman that half of them wanted to fall in love with and marry 50 years ago, but they didn't quite have the guts to do it, and they picked someone who seemed safer emotionally to them. And so you get, I don't know, you get this kind of thing which can be supportive and also rather bizarre at the same time. And he seems to fulfill that role for her.
If V.I. Warshawski were to get married, what kind of man would she marry?
Well, for the sake of this series, it would have to be someone whose work took him away from Chicago a lot.
maybe someone who plays for the Cubs.
God forbid, not... I think these athletes are fun to watch, but not so much fun to be close up to. The character in the books that I most wanted to have her have a long-term relationship with is a guy in Deadlock named Martin Bledsoe, who owns a shipping company, who seems to me... Now, how would I characterize him? Why did he seem to me to be so good for V.I.? He was someone who had a good enough sense of who he was, probably that he didn't need to be held up or protected from unpleasant truths about a woman in his life. And he was someone with his own strong personality at the same time. I wish I could describe it better. I liked him, and I keep wanting to bring him back and bring him back for her, but I haven't figured out a way to do it that's natural for the story.
There's a rumor that Kathleen Turner is going to play V.I. Warshawski.
This is very true. It's not a rumor.
Is it happening?
It's happening. They've finished filming. The movie will be released July 19th in a theater near you.
Which one?
Well, they started with Deadlock, my second book. And when they left Chicago at the end of November, having finished the location shots, they told me that they had to drop the last vestige of the story that was connected to what I had written. So that doesn't trouble me, really, because I think film is such a different medium from fiction that probably the worst movies are the ones that try scrupulously to follow a book exactly. What I like about what they've done, although I've tried hard to be minimally involved in it because I just don't want my own focus on what I'm doing to be taken over by what they're doing. But Turner is being fantastic on sticking to the integrity of the character and sticking up for the integrity of the character. So I'm really pretty pleased with what she's doing and how she's doing it.
Do you know the name of the movie?
No, they're calling it Warshawski, but I know that they want a title that will make people want to walk into a theater. I suggested On the Waterfront since they're setting it on the water.
Where would you place your books in relationship to other women mystery writers or in relation to other mystery writers in general or just other books in general?
You know, the hardest thing for me is to evaluate my own work. It always seems terrible to me. I can't stand to reread it once it's in print, and I don't know. It's like it's too hard for me to talk about it or think about it. It's in the American hard-boiled tradition, certainly, and it probably is more similar to Chandler and even to Robert Parker than it is to anything that anyone else is doing. You know, it's only different from them in ways. It's not different from them in degree or even vision. I don't claim to have had some wonderful new idea or insight with what I'm doing. I think that everyone writes out of what their own more or less unconscious issues and agendas are, and then what's probably different about my books is what the two of you have referred to a lot, the family and the past and those kinds of issues, but those are the important issues to me. Chandler had a whole different agenda where he needed to see himself as someone who was isolated, special, different in those kinds of ways, and so his character reflected that more.
Do you have any interest, Sarah Paresky, in writing any novels that do not have V.I. Warshawski?
Yes, I think that I've said what I have to say about V.I. at this point. She's a character who ages over time. She started out, she was 31, and she was born in 1952. I mean, she has a specific birth date, and she ages as time goes by. And I want to come back to her when she's old, older and old, if it's given to me to live that long. The stuff that she does is very much grounded in contemporary events, and I have to wait for time to pass. I can't suddenly plunk her down in the year 2020. But I'm under contract to do two books in the series, the one that I'm working on and another one, and I'm going to do some things that are totally non-crime fiction after that and see if I can do them. I may be like Colonel Sanders, you know, there may be just one thing that I can do and I'll have to keep doing it, but I'd like to see if I can do pizza as well as fried chicken.
You've been listening to a Probabilities Archive interview with Sarah Paresky, author of the V.I. Warshawski series of mysteries, recorded March 16, 1991 in the KPFA studios. My co-host was Richard A. Lupoff. Until next time, I'm Richard Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays or Mondays. For feedback and requests, you can write to Richard at kpfa.org or bookwaves@hotmail.com. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.